You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
it is vitally important for us, for all of us, to make a pressure to keep the promises about the ceasefire, about the withdrawal of the heavy artillery, about immediate release of all the hostages.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko, as fighting in his country intensifies ahead of a ceasefire scheduled for midnight tomorrow. I'll be discussing that and the day's other top stories with special guests Mary Dejewski and John Everard. We'll also hear from our correspondent in Brussels and from the Festival di San Remo. And finally,
find your way.
We'll be reviewing the best, the worst, and the indifferent in new films with the critic Tara Judah. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. An action-packed hour ahead of which Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
At least 11 Ukrainian soldiers have died and 40 more are wounded, while rebels say 7 civilians have been killed in fighting in eastern Ukraine since the Minsk ceasefire was announced. The violence comes despite the agreement reached on Thursday in Belarus, which is due to come to force this weekend. Under the deal, a buffer zone will be set up between rival fighters and heavy weapons will be removed from the front line. While the Secretary General of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Lambeta Zenier, said he's concerned at the latest fighting, but he believes it will die down.
We really expect these hostilities to terminate at the deadline that was set in Minsk, and we would really hope to see a decrease already between now and that moment. Withdrawing the heavy weapons doesn't mean demilitarizing the area, unfortunately. So there will be a need for further steps, and I think we should really look over time at a situation where also there is a military disengagement, but we are not there yet.
The main suspect in the rape of a Japanese tourist has now been arrested after surrendering to police in the northern Indian city of Jaipur. The 24-year-old Ajit Singh Chowdhury handed himself in at Dudu police station in the state of Rajasthan. He's accused of raping a 20-year-old woman last Sunday. The UN Refugee Agency confirmed on Friday an attack by Boko Haram fighters on a village in Chad, the first known lethal attack in that country by the Nigerian militant group, which killed several people, including a local chief, according to residents and security forces. Well, a UNHCR spokesman, Adrian Edwards, gave an update at a conference in Geneva.
We know that thousands of refugees were there. The reports that we've received, the town was attacked by about 30 militants using boats. They attacked parts of the town itself. Chef de Canton himself was killed. We were in contact with a refugee during the attack, but the phone line went dead. We're still trying to find out more about the situation.
Lebanese political leaders are participating in a commemoration ceremony in Beirut on the 14th of February to mark 10 years exactly since the assassination of the influential former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. On that day in 2005, Hariri, along with 22 others, were killed in a massive explosion on Beirut's waterfront shortly after leaving a parliament session. The killing plunged the country into its worst political crisis since the end of the 1975 to 1990 civil war. And around 100 people gathered at the barbed wire-bound gates of Malaysia's Sungai Buloh prison for a third night on Friday to stage a candlelit vigil for the jailed opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. A court found the 67-year-old former deputy prime minister guilty of sodomizing a former political aide. The vice president of the Keadilan Rakyat Party labeled Anwar's imprisonment completely unacceptable.
I ask the whole country, the rakyat in Malaysia, to stand up for their rights. It's come a time when we'll have to be brave, when we will have to show the government of the day that we are unhappy with what they have done, and we will at all levels try and make the changes happen in this country.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House. The time here in London is 18.05, which will make it 13.05 in New York City. Joining me in the studio with their take on today's news, we have Mary Dajewski, the chief editorial writer and columnist with The Independent, and John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea. Welcome both back to Midori House. We will start tonight in Ukraine, parts of which are currently subject to the rule of warfare, which holds that the most efficient way to ensure an intensification of fighting is to announce a ceasefire. The guns on both sides are due to fall silent at midnight tomorrow, but heavy fighting has been reported today in Debaltseve, Luhansk, Donetsk and other locations. Mary, it's not uncommon, obviously, for a telegraphed ceasefire to result in increased fighting as they try to claw what territory they may before the guns are supposed to stop. Once midnight does fall tomorrow night, how long would you be betting on it lasting?
Well, I've been an inveterate optimist right through the whole ceasefire process, which means that I've been wrong about 10 times. You have to say that this time around, the stakes are so much higher with the prospect of the Americans maybe giving heavy weapons to the Kiev government and the Russians then being absolutely bound to respond. That's the context that what's going on at the moment has to be seen in. And you have to hope that the people on the ground actually appreciate that. The problem is that where the previous ceasefires have come to grief is not actually in with any of the people who've signed the documents. They've come to grief on the ground, largely because the rebel fighters have no confidence whatever that the Kiev government is going to honour the undertakings for greater autonomy. That's what happens. And there is a risk that that'll happen again, because the rebels seem to me to be so divorced from everything else that's going on. They're fighting over their little bits of land.
John, to turn to you, of the many curiosities of this agreement, the one that strikes me as the greatest curiosity is that it contains a provision by which, as I understand it, Vladimir Putin promises to withdraw heavy weaponry that he still denies was ever sent to Ukraine in the first place.
Because Russia is not a part of the conflict, comrade. We are simply innocent bystanders and we are wringing our hands like everybody else. Yes, there are some really quite strange bits of the what has been agreed. It's true. But I think, nevertheless, this is a ceasefire, and the Russian press this morning has sensibly pointed out that a bad ceasefire is better than a good war. So let's hope that it does hold for a little while. I suspect, and I wouldn't want to bet on this, but I suspect that it will hold at least long enough to allow the two sides to exchange prisoners. I think that is important to both sides. They want their guys back, and there's a lot of prisoners at stake this time round.
Mary, it also strikes me that Russia, I was attempting optimism myself for quite a while during this conflict, and I've given up attempting anything. It gets more and more peculiar as it goes on. It does now just look to me, at least, to be the case that Vladimir Putin has pretty much got everything he could possibly have wanted, and there doesn't really appear to be anything anybody can do to persuade him to give it back. Why should he?
Well, I mean, it depends what you think Putin wanted in the first place, because I think that he wanted Crimea,
obviously,
to guarantee, as he saw it, Russia's security and their single warm water port. And he wanted the hinterland of Sevastopol to guarantee that security. I think that's how it was seen from Moscow. I don't think he ever wanted eastern Ukraine and the Donbass. And I think he wants it even less now, because the place is sort of devastated. The amount of investment that it's going to need for reconstruction, and the actual mood of the population there, which is going to be, I imagine, very stubborn and very hostile to Kiev, so that the prospects of reconciliation are going to be extremely difficult. This will be a liability for Russia if they had any closer relations with it. It'll be a liability for decades to come. I think they want a firm border and the Donbass to remain inside Ukraine. frankly, I don't think that Putin's ambitions currently go much beyond that.
John, if that is the case, how possible is it to tell how much control Vladimir Putin still has over events inside Ukraine? I mean, I'm not the first person to observe that it's an awful lot easier to start a war than finish one. Has the situation, the sort of, if it looks like a civil war and quacks like a civil war, etc., the civil war occurring in Ukraine, has it now spiraled beyond Putin's control?
I think that is entirely possible. How much control does he have? I harbour a suspicion that not even Vladimir Putin himself is entirely sure how much control he has. The rebels are clearly, they're dependent on him for all kinds of things, not least military hardware, but they don't seem to be taking direct orders from him, although I suspect some of their commanders are doing, but you know, what's going on the ground may not bear that much relation to what goes on in Vladimir Putin's head. Which brings us to the second point. You just asked Mary, has Vladimir Putin got everything he wants? I think there's a secondary question here. Have the rebels got everything that they want? And I think the answer to that is quite clearly no. There was quite a determined push for Mariupol not many weeks ago, which was rebuffed. The recent fighting looks to me like an attempt at a rapid land grab, but the Ukrainian government forces have, by and large, held the line. And even Donetsk Airport, the big prize, although the rebels now, I think, are in the terminal building, they can't use the airport because they still haven't managed to dislodge government forces from the outer building. So militarily, it hasn't really gone that well for them.
Mary, from Ukraine's point of view, could stroke should they just get used to the idea of a slightly vexed, restive and ornery Republika Rossiya, if you will, in the east of their country?
Well, it's going to take them a lot to get used to that. I think psychologically, Kiev, centre of Ukraine and western Ukraine have basically written off the East. They like the idea, they insist on the idea of what they call a unitary Ukraine. They want everything to be under Kiev's control and a minimum of devolution. Now, they've not achieved that, but the fact is that when you go to Kiev, as I did a couple of months ago, and you ask people, especially young people, and you say, would you be willing to fight to regain eastern Ukraine? I found nobody who was prepared to do that. And there is a sense in which I think they see, as the Easterners see themselves as somehow different, then the West and the centre of Ukraine increasingly sees the Donbass as something different. And while they want it in terms of national pride, they want the border to run around that, they actually see it as something rather different from themselves.
Could Poroshenko then just call Putin's bluff, say, all right, you want it, it's all yours?
I don't think you can do that for reasons of national pride. They're still saying that they want Crimea back, which is totally unrealistic. You know, even the Western powers acknowledge that Russia is not about to give Crimea back. And I think Poroshenko, he was elected after all. He's got an electoral mandate as president of Ukraine, which he got from pretty much every region of the country. And I don't think he is prepared to sacrifice that. He's given some ground in this peace deal. He's given more ground than he's given before in terms of devolution and what's being called special status. Special status, of course, is a nice word which has a rather fluid definition.
John,
could I to make a further point on that? That if Poroshenko did, as you say, call Putin's bluff and say, okay, here's Eastern Ukraine, take it, redefining Ukraine's borders, that changes the game in a way that is going to severely displease Putin, because as long as Kiev does not have full control over its entire territory, Ukraine cannot apply for NATO membership. The moment you redefine the borders so that everything is under Kiev's control, then Ukraine could apply for NATO membership, and I think NATO would find it very difficult to reject that application.
Well, Poroshenko is welcome to he can have that tip from me for free. It couldn't make things any worse, I wouldn't have thought. We will move along. I suspect we're going to have every chance to revisit this story once the ceasefire fails. At my betting, I think about 17 minutes past midnight. That's where my money is. We'll look at nearer Europe, nearer Western Europe. And back in 1995, of course, five European countries agreed to regard their borders as one. Since then, the Schengen area has expanded to include 26 European countries, between which anyone may now travel overland without producing a passport. Now, only a senior EU official could have failed to predict that this laxity might be exploited by miscreants and ne'er-do-wells, and now calls have been made for a strengthening of border controls. John, first of all, EU leaders meeting in Brussels. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve has been very keen on this idea. He's talking about tightening up controls to interdict terrorists. Is it really terrorists he's talking about?
Well, it's people who are going to commit violent acts. That's the ones he's trying to stop. Of course, there's a separate immigration issue here, which is a whole separate thing. The main problem with the entire Schengen project always has been that it is only as strong as its weakest link, and Schengen includes Greece. Now, Greek border controls are, frankly, a joke. They were a joke when Schengen was introduced. They have got steadily worse as the Greek economy has plummeted. And it is now so easy to get through Greece and then further into the Schengen area that the whole thing has become almost risible. There are two other points here that I don't think came out very clearly from the language in Brussels. Firstly, even if the nation states wanted to reintroduce border controls of some kind within the Schengen area, they would find it very difficult to do so because the entire infrastructure of those controls has been dismantled. There are no longer physical border posts, there are no longer border patrols or anything like that. Secondly, even if you could have an almost watertight external border, you do not stop acts of terrorism because so many of them are being committed by people who hold citizenship of one or other of the Schengen countries. So this might help to delay, it might stop some terrorist acts. It is not going to stop the terrorists in their tracks.
Mary, is this muttering from, and it's France and Spain who have been leading the muttering, is it, I guess, a belated recognition by the politicians currently under siege from various populist anti-EU parties that an awful lot of their own citizens were never really terribly happy with the idea of abandoning border controls, not necessarily for reasons of keeping terrorists out, but because people just, I don't know, it struck them as self-evident that borders should be controlled?
Well, I think it may be partly to do with that. I think it's also, it's an effort, given that the impetus is coming the stage from France, it's an effort in response to the Charlie Hebdo killings. It's a response to say we've got security at the top of our agenda and we intend to act on it. And it's not French security by and large that's to blame for any laxity. It's other people's security. So everybody can have a nice discussion in Schengen. But of course, John is absolutely right. The terrorist acts that this is supposed to counter are by and large not from people who've transgressed the Schengen boundary. They're from people who are born and bred in these countries. That applies to Britain, and as it applies to France, as it applies to other countries like Belgium. And I find it very hard to see that you can tighten up the Schengen border around the edge of the Schengen zone however much you want. But that is not going to change. I think there's one sort of sideline, little footnote to this, that in a way, the British government and David Cameron and people must be sitting smiling quite quietly on the sidelines, because security, even though Britain has obviously opted out of Schengen, nonetheless, security, what Britain sees as the laxity of security for the Schengen zone, is something that Britain goes on about repeatedly. So to see them, as it were, appearing to recognise that there's a problem, I think Cameron will smile to himself and talk about reforms in the EU and think that maybe his cause is not yet lost.
We will take a short break now on that note. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dejewski and John Everard. When we return, we will be asking, and not for the first time, what President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's problem is exactly, and we'll celebrate, for want of a better word, the 70th birthday of the Korean Workers' Party.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 at 20 past the hour. Still with me are Mary Dujewski and John Everard. Now, on a statistically average day, 44 people are murdered in the United States. If the president of the country spoke out about all of them, he'd never get anything else done. That notwithstanding, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, where half a dozen or so murders will be committed today, has publicly upbraided President Barack Obama for his alleged silence following the murders of three Muslim Americans in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, on Tuesday. John, we can assume, can't we, that President Barack Obama is broadly speaking against the mass murder of American civilians?
Yes, I think we can safely assume that. And I think we can also safely assume that he's against the mass murder of American civilians of whatever faith. One of the curiosities of Erdogan's remarks is that the Chapel Hill killings probably weren't hate killings. It looks like an argument over, of all things, a car parking space. So the kind of things that, you know, afflict suburban America.
It was amazing how quickly, though, people wanted to turn this into some sort of political argument, the assumption that there was a religious motivation to it. I mean, really, before the story had even... It was extraordinarily fast, is what I'm saying, even by modern standards.
Yes, you're quite right, it was. A lot of people rushed to turn this into a political issue, which it may well turn out not to be. We don't know yet, because we will probably find out more when we see what the suspect says in open court, which I think will be in a couple of weeks' time, perhaps. But the point that Erdogan makes, regardless of whether these killings were faith-motivated, seems to me to hold. That there is an imbalance in the way that Western leaders have been reacting to hate killings. We saw, on the one hand, this great display of solidarity, which we all applaud, I'm sure, over the Charlie Hebdo killings. But just within a couple of days of those killings, there was the Boko Haram massacre, and hardly a squeak from a Western leader. And it goes beyond that. The Chinese are fond of pointing out that to this day, President Obama has not condemned the Uyghur terrorists, or are they freedom fighters, who killed all those Chinese in Kunming last year. Remember the bomb that went off? So are the Western leaders in fact taking sides? Are they implicitly saying that there are good killings and bad killings? It's a bit difficult.
Well, one could equally point out that, you know, there's 16,000 American murders a year that President Erdogan says nothing about, but we don't assume that he's in favour of them. He also says that politicians are responsible, as he puts it, for events in their countries and need to clarify their stance. So I would suggest that he might want to deal with the fact that, and this is a real poll, I looked it up, 44% of Turks think the Charlie Hebdo massacre was a false flag operation by Western intelligence. 43% thought the real victim of the Charlie Hebdo massacre was the Islamic world. Only 22% thought the real victims were the actual victims. And 61% of AKP voters think those who insult Islam should be punished. Mary, who is President Erdogan playing to here, really?
That's interesting that you frame the question like that, because that was exactly going to be my answer to whatever question you gave, which was that I think he's playing first and foremost to his own domestic audience. I think he fancies cutting a figure, more high-profile figure on the international stage. But in order to do that, he needs to play to domestic opinion as well. And that's where I think his priorities were with this. I think at the same time, he has all sorts of domestic problems with dissent, with locking people up for their opinions, the question of Islam and how far fundamentalist Islam may be sort of making inroads into what used to be regarded as sort of proudly secular Turkey. So he has problems, and I think that particular statement reflects those more than it reflects anything else.
Okay, well, finally tonight, yesterday at around this time, we reviewed the latest outpourings of Pyongyang's overworked copywriters, who have cranked out more than 300 new slogans and mottos, celebrating the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Korean Workers' Party, who have spent those seven decades, as Christopher Hitchens once noted, behaving like people who mistook George Orwell's 1984 for an instruction manual. John Everard, you know North Korea better than most non-North Koreans. What did you make of the new slogans? Did you have any particular favourites?
I love the idea of filling the country with the fragrance of fish. And I love equally the idea of turning North Korea into a mushroom country.
Yeah, I wondered at that point whether somebody has a quiet sense of humour in there, because there is, of course, the old joke about mushrooms, etc.
Yes, indeed. I'm not sure the joke translates well into Korean. But sometimes I do think that Korean slogan writers are sort of a bit tongue-in-cheek. The whole repertoire of Korean slogans is full of gems, right down from Kim Jong-il being the son of the 21st century to, as I say, fields full of mushroom-munching Koreans. I mean, it's a never-ending gift to journalists.
It is. Well, this is what I was wondering yesterday as well. It is. I think there's a reflex, certainly outside North Korea, to respond to this sort of nonsense with a certain amount of tittering, if not outright guffaws. Should we be laughing at North Korea, really? Because it is what it is. It is an obviously fairly awful place. Are we doing the right thing in finding it funny?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, we obviously shouldn't find it funny because it's quite a dangerous place. It's got nuclear weapons, which actually it seems to manage rather badly. And it feels, to the extent that it feels paranoid, it becomes an even greater danger. On the other hand, I mean, it is fantastic, is it not, that there is still a country like North Korea? I mean, we're rapidly losing Cuba as one of the last vestiges of old-style Cold War communism. So I think, you know, it would be nice to keep North Korea just for a little bit. And I see that they're planning a full-scale, full-dress military parade for the 70th anniversary. So I think, you know, I'd quite like to be cheering with a flag on the sidelines there, actually.
Well, that may be possible. I was talking to the North Koreans earlier today. I was at the great birthday party. And they were saying that for this great event, they intend to relax normal restrictions on visits by journalists. So there's your chance. In you go. Take your flag with you.
Can you put me down for an invitation? I'd be very curious to see that.
Well, we'll see what we can do.
Okay, we'll see what we can sort out. But John, this 70th anniversary, there will be parades and dances, etc., etc., etc. Again, you would have a better idea of this than almost anybody. What will it actually? There will be the ways in which North Koreans are obliged, I'm sure, to observe the festivities and the celebrations. What will they? And again, generalizing about an entire nation, etc., etc. What will they actually be thinking?
I know it seems counterintuitive, but the North Koreans I knew actually enjoyed these great festivals. Firstly, it's a day off work, which can't be bad.
Okay, there's that.
Secondly, you get lots of spectacle, you get lots of music, and it's quite fun watching tanks trundle through otherwise dull streets. Thirdly, you get a street party. There aren't many occasions in North Korea when you can go and dance in the street. But big festivals like this are one of them. And I remember that friends of mine used to agonise for days before any of these festivals about whether they could remember all the dance steps. The big terror of a young North Korean at these moments is not nuclear warfare, it's treading on the toes of your dancing partner.
Mary, how do you think the outside world should react to these celebrations? Would it freak the North Koreans out completely if they were just deluged in congratulations from the outside world?
Well, it would be a nice thing to do, wouldn't it? A sort of love bombing of North Korea. The problem is that they've so talked themselves into this sort of paranoid mindset that I think we'll have to do a lot more of that to make them feel relaxed and come out of their shell a bit more.
And the trouble with love bombing is that North Koreans tend to see love bombing, I love that phrase, as foreigners correctly bearing tribute to the superior North Korean state. It's not really a country that regards anybody else as an equal. You are either an enemy or a tributary.
On a more serious note, though, should we anticipate at some point them celebrating the 70th anniversary with some mindlessly belligerent gesture towards their near or far enemies?
Why wait for an anniversary? I mean, just last week, they tested a ship-killing missile and fired, I think, it's half a dozen short-range missiles. I'm sure they'll keep that kind of pantomime rolling right through to the great day.
John Everard and Mary Dujewski, thank you both very much for joining us. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still ahead in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our correspondent in Brussels, reviewing the best in the week cinema and hearing from the Festival di Sanremo as well. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. At least 11 Ukrainian soldiers have died and 40 more are wounded, while rebels said 7 civilians have been killed in fighting in eastern Ukraine since the Minsk ceasefire was announced. The violence comes despite the agreement reached on Thursday in Belarus, which is due to come into force this weekend. The main suspect in the rape of a Japanese tourist has been arrested after surrendering to police in the northern Indian city of Jaipur. The UN Refugee Agency confirmed today an attack by Boko Haram fighters on a village in Chad, the first known lethal attack in that country by the Nigerian militant group, which killed several people, including a local chief. And Lebanese political leaders are participating in a commemoration ceremony in Beirut on the 14th of February to mark 10 years exactly since the assassination of the influential former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24, 31 minutes past the hour, specifically 31 minutes past 1800 here in London. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're going to Brussels to speak to Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. Charlotte, the ceasefire in Ukraine, which we were talking about at the top of the programme, was of course brokered by Francois Hollande and Angela Merkel. It's notable that neither of them have been overselling it. Does the EU or people within the EU regard this as a diplomatic triumph?
I think triumph is pushing it a little bit. There was an EU leaders summit here yesterday, and speaking to diplomats on the sidelines, and also the impression you get from some of the comments from the leaders is quite deep scepticism, in fact, over whether the terms of the ceasefire will hold. They've all seen the previous ceasefire in Minsk back in September, and that didn't really work out exactly as they imagined it. And it was only a few days ago that the EU had threatened a new round of sanctions against Russia. So there's also a little bit of suspicion over the timing. Is this agreement being signed up to just because of this looming threat of sanctions? So we got quite a hard line when the leaders' summit wrapped up last night. They vowed to go ahead with sanctions that were already agreed, and there were quite stern warnings that more EU sanctions would come, deeper economic sanctions would, unless Russia stuck to the terms of the agreement.
How bothered or otherwise are people by the fact that nothing the EU has done so far appears to have corrected or altered Russia's behaviour?
Depends who you ask, really. I think that that some people will argue that the sanctions, well, they have had an economic effect on Russia, that's indisputable. And you will hear voices saying, well, the fact that the sanctions have economic effect, that could have pushed Putin to this negotiating table, to these talks in Minsk. Whereas, on the other hand, you do still get some nations, particularly Eastern European nations with close ties to Russia, whose own economies are suffering from these sanctions, saying, look, it hasn't had any effect at all on Russia's decision-making. We have to find a different way. We have to pursue diplomacy. So again, we get both sides of the argument, and those sort of splits aren't going away.
Is there any tendency at all that you can detect for, I guess, the taking the hint option, which would just be to say, OK, we tried, there wasn't really anything we could do, it's not really our problem, we should probably just let things sort themselves out?
Well, the issue is it is the EU's problem. I mean, this is a conflict at the heart of Europe. It's right on the EU's doorstep. It was all, you know, going back a year and a half, it was all linked to the EU trying to extend its trade ties, its political ties with former Soviet nations. So it very much is the EU's problem, and they do see it that way. I don't think there's any room at all for just letting whatever happens in Ukraine continue. That's not really an option for the leaders here.
Okay, well, moving along to what is definitely and unarguably the EU's problem, and indeed has been for some 3 years or so now, is Greece. There's a meeting of Eurozone finance ministers on Monday. Does anybody have any great hopes that this is going to sort everything out?
Well, the man who has the rather thankless task of overseeing that meeting or chairing that meeting, that's the Dutch finance minister, Dijsselbloem, he doesn't sound very hopeful. He's just recently said that he's still very pessimistic of a swift deal on Monday. So the the least we can expect is a very, very, very late night, more likely an early morning on Tuesday. But it's still not even clear if there's any common ground that they found yet between the Greece demands that the Troika lenders be broken up and a new deal be brokered, or the on the other side, their creditors' demands that Greece first finish the bailout program they've already signed up. Now, this is really the key sticking point, and we're seeing no sign of manoeuvring on either side. However, it is important to note that today Alexis Tsipras was in Brussels. He was here last night for the EU Leader Summit. He stayed on today to meet with the heads of the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Commission. Now, this is the Troika, which he says doesn't even exist anymore. So I think that there's some encouragement from some EU leaders that the fact that he's even sitting down with these institutions is a good sign that that there is political willingness to find a deal.
Who has the upper hand as far as it's possible to tell? Is it the EU or is it Greece? Because I'm reminded a little bit of that old joke which suggests that if you owe the bank £1 million, you've got a problem, but if you owe the bank £100 million, the bank's got a problem.
I would say at the moment it's probably the creditors, and that's because Greece's current bailout expires at the end of February. There's still €7 billion outstanding that Greece really does need to pay its debt. So it really is a case of the clock ticking. If they can't come up with an agreement very soon, because any agreement has to be ratified by various national parliaments, then Greece will default on its debt and leave the eurozone, and nobody wants that. So Greece does have this hanging over its head. What Greece can do, of course, is say, well, if we don't get a new deal, this is going to happen. This could lead to Greece leaving the eurozone, as I mentioned. And nobody in Europe really wants that, because that will have repercussions on other member states. Germany, who doesn't want any impact on its economy at all. So both have some jokers up their sleeves. But I would say at the moment, because of this deadline looming, because of this outstanding money, the EU does have a slight upper hand.
And finally, I want to talk about a local story in Belgium, which is an astonishing trial, really. A court in Antwerp has convicted 45 people, no less, for recruiting fighters for Syria. How big a story has this been in Belgium?
It's massive here, even more so because of the terror raids last month. You may remember the police raided a property in the town of Verviers. They ended up killing two suspected terrorists in the firefight. And that made the headlines because it came so soon after the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris. The issue of extremism in Belgium, this issue of foreign fighters going to Syria and the potential risk they pose when they return home, it's very much an issue that people here care about. So there was a lot of attention for this trial. I mean, it's one of the biggest, it is the biggest ever in Belgium, and I think that it's possibly one of the biggest in the EU at the moment, because all the other countries, it's not just Belgium, but other countries, France, Germany, the UK, Scandinavian countries, are all really looking at how they can stop this recruitment, this flow of foreign fighters to the Syrian conflict and their return radicalized. So it's potentially a litmus test as well as to whether the courts are the ones placed to deal with this.
Has anybody had any bright ideas? And I know it's a problem across Europe, not just in Belgium, but about what it is that is appealing to people who grow up somewhere as basically pleasant and comfortable as Belgium is. What is appealing about leaving that for the battlefields of Syria?
I think it varies from country to country. And certainly in Belgium, there's quite high youth unemployment here. And there's quite dissatisfaction. There hasn't been the integration of community many had hoped for. There's still quite a prejudice and discrimination running through in the legal system and employment. But there's various issues that people are able to tap. And I think the key with Belgium is that this group, Sharia for Belgium, this is the group that most of the members of, most of the people who were convicted were members of this group, they were then able to tap into this dissatisfaction. And I think that's where there is some success. They had a very charismatic leader, a man by the name of Fouad Belkacem. He was able to, he gave street sermons. He also harnessed the power of the internet. And I think it was his charisma and his ability to tap into this dissatisfaction which gives Belgium this particularly high per capita proportion of foreign fighters heading over to Syria. He was sentenced to 12 years. So it remains to be seen whether this is going to have an effect on the flow of foreign fighters back and forth.
Charlotte McDonald-Gibson in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we're heading to San Remo.
Who said print was dead? certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. We're continuing in Sanremo, which has this week hosted Italy's most popular music contest, the Festival di Sanremo. The winning act of this year's festival will get to represent Italy at the Eurovision Song Contest in May. The finale takes place tomorrow. Monocle's Marcos Hippi spoke earlier to the journalist Renato Aguiglio, who told us more about the competition and revealed who he is expecting to be this year's winner.
The great final day is tomorrow, but the mechanism is very simple. It's a mixed vote. There is a quality jury and televoting. Meanwhile, the Italian press will design the critics' award. There are three artists which are going to play for the final and are Neck, the rising star of Italian music, Nina Zilli, and the young trio, Il Volo.
You've got already three suggestions for us, three acts you want to mention in specific. And the first one we are hearing from is a group called Il Volo, and the song is Grande Amore. How much can you tell us about them?
So they are a younger group. They are coming out from a talent. They perform in the... they are international performer, but not very known in Italy. So for them is also an opportunity.
And how would you describe their music?
Usually is popular melodic music with a bit electronic, but more principally is popular and melodic.
Well, Renato, let's have a quick listen of Il Volo's song Grande Amore.
Dimmi perché quando penso, penso solo a te. Dimmi perché quando vedo, vedo solo a te. Dimmi perché quando credo, credo solo in te. Grande amore.
That was Amore, Grande Amore even, by Il Volo, and we are joined on the line by Renato Aguiglio, journalist from Sanremo. After Il Volo, we have another act that you want to mention in specific. How much can you tell us about Neck?
Neck is a ritual for Neck on a Sanremo festival after 20 years, and he presents a new song, and is one of the most appreciated artists by the Italian press.
So he's been performing for quite some time. He was already in Sanremo in 1996. How well do you remember that performance?
I was too young, so I don't remember that performance. But he, of course, he was a great song, a successful song that people nowadays recognize can also sing.
Well, let's listen to music by Neck straight away. This is Fatti Avanti Amore.
Abbiamo gambe per fare passi, trovarci persi, avvicinarci e poi abbiamo bocche per dare baci, o meglio dire per assaggiarci. Se un pianto ci fa nascere un senso a tutto il male, forse c'è, io sono pronto a vivere, ti guardo e so perché.
I quite like that. That was Neck with Fatti Avanti Amore. We're joined on the line by Renato Aguiliu, journalist. How much more can you tell us about Neck?
He is a great singer, but he is not so abroad. But in Italy, he's a star. He's a really, really great artist.
A big name in Italy. Well, let's continue with one more song from this year's Sanremo Festival. Let's continue with Nina Zilli. How would you introduce her to us?
Absolutely the rising star of Italian music. She comes from an underground music, and now she is almost a great artist, almost a big singer. So she is trying with this Sanremo Festival to earn the great respect, the great knowledge to the public.
Yeah, maybe a publicity breakthrough over there indeed for Nina Zilli. And the song she's going to sing is called Sola. Let's have a listen.
Sola, e gli altri ballano, mi piace farmi male e ricordare la felicità cos'è. Sola, anche prima di dormire, lo vedi fuori piove.
That was Nina Zilli with Sola, and as Renato just mentioned, she's hoping for a massive breakthrough at this year's Sanremo Festival. I'm wondering, Renato, who do you think, who is going to win? Have you got a wild guess?
I hope, because I prefer Nina Zilli, but it's a hard battle, I think the younger trio Il Volo has a lot of chances.
That was Renato Aguiliu, a journalist at Sanremo News, speaking to Monocle's Marco Sippi earlier. It's time now for some music on Midori House, or some more music, rather, after that. And this is more music from the Sanremo Festival. This is a collaboration between two Sanremo winners, so it must be good. This is Giorgia and Eros Ramazzotti with Inevitabile.
L'amore poi cos'è? Dammi una definizione.
Anche a me, come a te,
come a te.
That was Giorgia with Eros Ramazzotti. The song was Inevitabile, among other things. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now for our daily arts review. Today, because it's, what day is it? It's Friday, which is when we usually talk films. We're talking them today with Tara Judah, film critic and curator who has programmed at various festivals around the world, as well as for Melbourne's Astor Theatre. First of all, these films are all being playing at the Berlinale, or Berlin Film Festival.
Yes, I've just been in Berlin and returned a little bit exhausted, but...
Okay, exhausted in a good way?
In a good way, yeah. Look, some of the films were really great. So there is that sort of sense of excitement about running around Potsdamer Platz trying to see great films. Not all of them are going to be living up to your expectations, but I have to say there was one that really stood out for me this year. That was the Alex Ross Perry film, Queen of Earth.
And why did this stand out for you?
Mainly because of the character performances. This is really a point of departure for Alex Ross Perry. People will know him for his deadpan humour. His most recent film, Listen Up, Philip, is one that is very much that sort of nihilistic American indie type of film. But this is really a different way and a different direction for him to go in. So this is a much more ethereal character work. And it stars Elizabeth Moss and Catherine Waterston. And the two of them play friends who have been friends for a very long time, and now one of the characters is going through a very personal depression. And so they go to a place in the woods, basically, where they can sort of relax and maybe work through some of those problems. It's a very tranquil place. So this is that getting away from the city type narrative. But what we see through the flashbacks of other times that they've been there together and their friendship and what that history is that actually their privilege and their entitlement means that perhaps all of the empathy and altruism has been sucked out of their friendship long ago. And it's quite a bitter film in many ways. But Elizabeth Moss's performance of depression, of mental illness, of somebody really on the brink of collapse, and the way in which that subtlety plays out is just fantastic.
Okay, well, that's a fairly full-throated recommendation for Queen of Earth there. I want to move along to Knight of Cups, starring Christian Bale and Natalie Portman, which has had what might be charitably described as mixed reviews.
Yes, I think that is charitable. I have to say I really didn't get along with this film at all. This is the latest from Terrence Malick, and it's not that I wasn't expecting the whispering philosophy and the visual motifs of women running alongside the beach, smiling and laughing, because I have seen Tree of Life and To the Wonder. I very much like Tree of Life. He lost me a little with To the Wonder, but this one really is just overkill. I think he's...
Is there too many women in flouncy dresses running along beaches?
There really are. There's a ream of them from Cate Blanchett, Imogen Poots, Natalie Portman, Nikki Whelan, Isabel Lucas. There's so many of them. And really, we get no sense of character from any of the females in this film at all. It's just purely from the main character Rick, which is played by Christian Bale. It's from his perspective. But from what I understand as well, Christian Bale wasn't really given too much direction as to what was actually going to be going on in the scenes, because it's all narrated over with this sort of wispy Hegelian type of philosophical musings that, to be honest, really amount to very little.
It does sound insufferable. We have a clip of that to demonstrate.
All those years living the life of someone I didn't even know.
From Knight of Cups there by Terrence Malick. That sounds awful.
It is.
Okay, I suspect I'm never going to know. I will take your word for it. Finally, we need to look at a film from the old country, which is to say both our native land. This is The Turning, which is, it's adapted from a book by Tim Winton, but the book is a bunch of short stories.
It is. It's a bunch of short stories that has been the best-selling short story collection in Australia for a very long time since it hit the shelves. It's extraordinarily popular. It really gives a depiction of what Australian coastal life is like. So it's set in West Australia in a small coastal village. It has a loose narrative of some recurring characters popping up throughout the stories, but there is also great divergence in terms of what sort of characters we have coming and going. So it's a lot about relationships, a lot about family, and a lot about what that sort of breezy, slow Australian life is like. And this film really does that justice. I mean, it's 17 different directors, 17 different adaptations of each of those stories, an incredible cast across those works. We have people like Hugo Weaving, Cate Blanchett, Jackie Weaver, and directors as well, Jonathan Alfdehyde, Robert Connolly, who put the whole thing together. He's the one who basically orchestrated the adaptation. Tim Winton himself said that he thought the idea was quite mad and that Robert Connolly was crazy for taking it on. I think that's fair. Some of the pieces work better than others. Certainly, the Justin Kurzel is a standout for me.
Okay, well, if we're quick, I think we have a clip of The Turning.
What did it feel like the moment you suddenly got it?
I saw things. Well, I don't know, I half saw things.
You used to treat me like a trophy. I was your prize. What did it feel like?
the moment you turned.
That's from The Turning. Finally, and relatively briefly, if you could, does it have something to say, capital S, capital T, capital S, about modern Australia?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it has something to say about the way in which people are still searching for something in that great expanse. I mean, it's a huge country, and the film deals with it, I think, in a really great way. It brings more to the story than the book does. It has some Indigenous sections as well, but it says something about Australian life and that sort of wandering timelessness of coastal towns.
Tara Judith, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Mary Dajewski and John Everard. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, research by Max Koshik and Stefano Fumagalli, and our studio manager was Chris Grimes. Next up, after the headlines, Marcus Hippie is back with The Menu. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 London. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.